Hey, y'all, before we get into this episode, I want to let you know I had some audio issues. My computer was doing a whole lot of different things. If you hear some things change up, just deal, okay? We love you. We appreciate you. Now let's get on in it.
Hey there, beautiful people. Welcome to Fantasy, the podcast for all those complex and complicado conversations about the gray areas in our lives. I'm entertainment journalist, editor, authoress times two and more, Travell Anderson.
And I am a journalist, producer, author, frequent flyer, almost gold on Delta, Jarrett Hill. Coming up on the show today, we are talking to one of our faves. Keith Boykin is here and going to talk to us about, as Travell would say, Zaddy Keith. Is here to join us, and we're very excited to talk about his brand new book called Quitting, Why I Left My Job for a Life of Freedom. And rather than getting into a whole bunch of other conversations, we're going to just jump right on in. The global pandemic has brought us so many unforeseen circumstances. One of them, the Great Resignation, or as Forbes called it, the Big Quit. More and more people are walking away from their jobs and taking different paths than before the funky COVIDina really locked us all up in the house. Now, in the new book, Quitting, Why I Left My Job for a Life of Freedom, available exclusively on new platform Scribd, which, for the record, I pronounced both loud and wrong on the show last week, our guest is telling us why he's empowered himself to walk away from the things that don't make him happy, from relationships and people to the cities he's lived in and the very cool jobs he's had. From working in the White House to ditching New York City for a much better Los Angeles, I'm super intrigued. And I'm low-key kind of emulating Keith Boykin here in his freedom. Back for his third time on our show. Keith Boykin, welcome back to Fantai.
Wow, Jared, thank you. That was a really loaded introduction.
It was.
There's just so much to think about with this. Because like one of the things that I really appreciated in the book, you said that you've not had a full-time job since you left the White House, working for President Clinton 25 years ago. You said, I've not had a full-time job. And I've personally not had a full-time job since April of about 2015 when I got laid off in Tampa Bay. And I'm like, it has to be something really amazing that I really wanted to do to go back to another full-time job. It would have to be something that I was really excited about, right? And so I'm hearing that and it's sitting with me and I'm thinking to myself, like, how are you thinking about what you're doing every day? Like, as you're building out like your work life and trying to figure out what you want to do, how do you think about that?
I'm glad you said that, because you can definitely relate to the experience that I've had. And I've also said the same thing to myself. Like, I'm not opposed to having a full-time job. It's just that after I left my last full-time job, I decided I wasn't going to go back to another full-time job unless it was something that actually had added some real value to my life. I mean, I suppose if I was like president of the United States, which I would never want to do, or, you know, or the CNN news anchor or something like that, which is something I'm not sure I would want to do either. But, something that would be worth my time, I would consider doing it. But I don't want to just go to a job anymore. I'd rather, even with all the insecurity and the potential instability of being self-employed and not always financially certain how that's going to work, I prefer the freedom of that than the certainty of going to a monotonous job they don't love every day. So that's part of the experience for me. You know, like you said before, we had this great resignation last year. 47 million people quit their jobs, and they quit for a lot of different reasons. Some people wanted to be entrepreneurs or try something on their own. Some people were just upset with their work conditions. Some people wanted more pay or wanted to switch careers. But for whatever reason, people are starting to realize that they don't have to live on these sort of pre-planned treadmills that have been created for us, where we just have to go to work every day from 9 to 5. We have to be in office. We have to be there 52 weeks a year. We get maybe 1 or 2 weeks of vacation if we're lucky. And we really don't get a vacation because our bosses are calling us or texting us and emailing us during that time as well. And at some point, I think, you know, COVID was one of those disrupting influences that told us, like, wait a minute, why are we doing this? We realized, well, we can work at home. We can work on the beach, for God's sake. We can work at our parents' homes or wherever we might be, you know, during this whole lockdown. Why are we going to offices and being around people who are miserable every day and making ourselves miserable? It doesn't make any sense.
So This is interesting to me because I remember this piece of data came out, and Travell, you and I talked about this as well. There was a piece of data that came out probably middle of like the pandemic that was saying that like 97% of Black people didn't want to go back to the jobs in the office. And I was like, I figured I wasn't surprised that it was a high number, but I was surprised by how high that number was. And I think,
but you know, black folks always be like, fuck that job. We ain't never want to go back to the job.
100%. And it's like, it's a
COVID or no COVID.
COVID, no COVID, right? The number was probably 96% beforehand, right? Like, it was beforehand. But like, going into the office is something that everyone is not a fan of. And when you think about, you know, the racial dynamic, the sexuality, gender, all of the different things that we face in the workplace. It's frustrating. And I've been arguing with myself about the concept of Will Smith like work ethic, right? Like, I've always heard Will Smith talk about how he nobody's gonna ever outwork him, right? He was like, you might be a better actor, you might be cuter, you might be taller, you might be fitter, you might be this, but I'm gonna outwork you. And if you get on a treadmill next to me, I'm gonna die before you're gonna beat me on the treadmill. And I've always been like, okay, sure, girl. Like, that sounds great for you, but like, it's never resonated with me. How do you think about work ethic and like just that as a concept? Because I think it's some capitalist bullshit.
I agree with you. I think it is capitalist bullshit. And yet, at the same time, I understand it because I was brainwashed to believe that same mentality for most of my life, that you have to keep working, 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 work harder, and you'll be more successful. And part of the truth that I started to unravel when I was working on this book is that working harder doesn't necessarily produce better results. I mean, it can in some instances, but it doesn't always do that. And there are a lot of people, this is one of the examples I mentioned in the book, there are a lot of people who are working their butts off every day, going to very difficult jobs, thinking that somehow that's going to magically transform into some great new life for them. But working hard doesn't necessarily produce that. It's a lot about being in the right place at the right time, meeting the right people, and sometimes just circumstance and chance. Yes, you can put your heart into something, do everything you possibly can, but you may not have the right connection, the right resources, the right ability to be able to make that thing happen. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do it if you want to do it. My objective, my point of view, my perspective is I actually like the work I do. I want to continue working, but I want to do work that I want to do, not work that my boss wants me to do. I want to work on my own schedule. You know, sometimes I might wake up at 2 a.m. and say, you know, I have an idea for a movie or a book or something like that. Let me write this down. I don't want to feel like I can't focus on the things I want to wake up or want to think about because I'm focused on things that somebody else, my employer, is always wanting me to think about. So I just love that freedom. Yes, I work. In fact, I feel like one of the great ironies, I've been telling people about this lately, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, Jared, but one of the great ironies about where I am in this moment is that I've been working my ass off this year. I've been working harder this year than I think I have worked in years. And here I am going around telling everybody to quit their jobs. I'm not really saying quit your jobs, but I'm just saying, you know, it's funny because I'm working hard, but I'm working on stuff that I believe in, I care about. And so at any point I could stop. I could say, you know what? I want to do this. I want to do something else. But that's what I mean about the freedom. Yes, if you want to work, you want to work hard, go ahead and do it. But for God's sake, don't be forced to do it for somebody else's agenda all the time.
One of the things that I want to make sure that I'm clear about is like, as we're talking about work ethic, I want to be distinct that I don't mean about doing good work, right? I don't mean I think doing good work is bullshit. I think like this idea that we're supposed to just work and work and work and work and work and work. I think about that Cadillac commercial that we've probably discussed here before years ago, where the man was talking about, we work our asses off and blah, 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 blah. And people were like, why do we do that? Like, why is that the cool thing for all of us to just, you know, work ourselves and grind, grind, grind? And I did a tweet last week talking about how I've been talking with my therapist about how much I hear myself talking about how much I work, right? Like, I was in pre-show with y'all and I was saying to Travelle and Laura, like, yesterday was a 20-hour day, right? Long day, hosting a thing in the morning, then traveling, getting back home, doing work on the plane, blah, 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 blah. And I told my therapist that I hear myself saying it all the time. And I'm like, why am I always saying it, right? Like, why am I so proud of how much I'm overworking myself? Why am I so like committed to overworking myself and being exhausted and like all of that? Like, it feels like it's not as valuable as I would like to think it is.
I think you hit the nail on the head, Jared. And, you know, because I've worked with you in the past in TV projects, I know from experience you work hard and you work harder than almost anybody I know, to be honest. And that's a lot. And I applaud you for your ability to do it because I think you're working on projects that you love and care about. But at the same time, I don't really feel like I feel like I'm a slacker compared to you. I don't feel like I work anywhere nearly as hard as other people around me. And part of it is because, I don't know, I just, maybe I'm at a different place in my life now. I just don't feel like I want to or care as much about it. But I also feel like it's not the way I want to live my life where I'm working all the time. So that's why I say this year is such an anomaly. And I go back to the experience I talked about in the book when I was in Spain, when this first clicked to me when I was a college student. I was doing a foreign study program and I met this bartender who said to me that Americans, that we live to work. And in Spain, they work to live. And I thought, wow, it never occurred to me before, but that is so familiar. That we spend so much of our lives in this country focused on work. Our identities are centered around our work. When you meet somebody, the first thing we ask them is, what do you do for work? I saw you tweeted, I think, the other day, something about, why do we ask kids, what do you want to do when you grow older, as opposed to, who do you want to be? You know, there's this whole sort of sense of work has defined who we are as humans in this country. And this is all part of the whole capitalist structure that doesn't give us value or worth for our identities, irrespective of whether we do anything. If you sit on your butt all day and watch TV, if you read a book all day, if you decide you're going to go to the beach all day, whatever you do today, you are still worthy of love. You're still a human being deserving of love and freedom and justice and equality and liberty and all the wonderful things that we associate with this country. And you shouldn't have to be constantly producing things in order to get that. The other last point about this is that a lot of people are working a lot and they're still not able to support themselves, which is one of the reasons why I'm so disturbed. And I talk about this in the whole chapter called The Broken Social Contract, that people who do work 40 hours a week should be able to support themselves. I don't care if you're working at McDonald's or working at a gym or working at a hotel or wherever you're working. If you're working 40 hours a week at a job, you should be able to support yourself. And we used to have a minimum wage that increased to allow people to be able to take care of themselves. It was a livable wage. It hasn't increased in more than a decade in this country now. We've fallen into this trap. We call people lazy, like Kim Kardashian was doing. We call people lazy because they're not successful and rich. We're calling them lazy, but we create a system that makes it impossible for them to succeed.
I'm with everything that y'all said, you know, 10 out of 10.
No, I hear a butt. I hear a butt coming.
Right. A big old butt. How you going to do a 10 out of 10 with a butt and a however, comma? Right.
However, comma. Okay. I'm also thinking of, you know, the folks who are like, who also similarly hear, right, this vision, right, of a life that both of you are articulating and don't see how they can have that in their own reality, right? Because they are that person working 40 hours at McDonald's. They don't have a livable wage. And so quitting, right, working for themselves, following a passion does not seem like something that they can do. And so my question is, you know, and you already kind of made the broader critique of like the system, right, at play and those types of things that we need to work on. But I'm wondering for one, how do you think about what privilege looks like in a conversation like this? And then two, how you kind of see or think that people can take away from your book, you know, using this idea where they are, right? Considering all of the isms and obias and systems that, you know, gonna take a little bit longer for us to work on in the meantime.
I think you're exactly right. It's a great question. I was a little wary at first, but it was a great question.
I was nervous too for you. I was scared.
You know, I think you're right. I acknowledge in my life experience and in the book, I talk about my own privilege. I've had lots of opportunities that have not been afforded to other people. I graduated from two Ivy League schools. I worked in the White House. I worked for CNN. You know, I've never missed a meal in my day. I grew up in a family that was always middle class. So for me, I feel like my experience is different from the experience of a lot of people. But that experience has also empowered me to understand how and why I think other people should have, if not necessarily exact same, but similar opportunities in their lives to live with some sort of sense of autonomy and agency and freedom as well. So for people who don't have that sense of privilege, A, there's the macro level, which you talked about before, which is deconstructing the system that that traps us in this oppressive work culture. So we don't have to continue to force people to work two and three jobs just to be able to pay their bills and still not be able to take care of themselves. But B, there's a whole trend that's been talking we've been talking about lately in American society the past 2 months since August, which I talk about in the book, but I don't go into detail about it in that context, called quiet quitting. And I don't use those words in my book, but quiet quitting is this whole sort of phenomenon of people doing exactly what they're supposed to do at work, but not doing more than they're supposed to do, and creating boundaries for themselves and their employers. So yes, if I'm supposed to work 40 hours a week, I'm going to work that 40 hours a week, but you're not going to make me come here and stay an extra day or an extra hour or an extra anything. You're not going to make me work for more without compensating me. I am now, because of the change in the labor market, I now have some more autonomy to be able to negotiate for myself a little bit of a higher wage than what I had before, because employers are having such a difficult time trying to find jobs, which is one of the reasons why I think employees are at a little bit of a better advantage right now than they have been in a long, long time. And I also understand that I can't contribute to, and this is one of the most important things, especially as we're approaching a midterm election, I cannot contribute to a system that oppresses me. And part of the reason why people do this is there are people who are low income or moderate income people in rural and urban and suburban communities who are predominantly white, who are voting against their own economic interest on a regular basis because they're voting for people who will not do the right thing for them. So one of the most important things you can do if you're in a position where you don't have that privilege is to challenge those people who are disempowering you to create us. We have people out there who are advocating for a livable minimum wage. Vote for those people. Vote for the people who are going to provide health care for you. People who are going to make sure that you can afford to send your kids to college if you want to, or be able to send them to a good school, a public school. Vote for the people who are trying to create affordable housing for you, who are trying to clean up your environment, the people who are making sure you have a fair criminal justice system for you and your children. Vote for those people. That's the one of the most important ways that you can disrupt the system and change the sort of work-life culture and your imbalance in the system between you and your employer.
I'm fascinated by this because I think it speaks to something that we always talk about in diversity, equity, inclusion conversation about how we need to think about how we qualify things or qualify candidates, qualify success, qualify failure, all of those things, and how we're measuring all of those different kinds of things. And so it makes me wonder for you, with this perspective that is so, you know, counter, right? It's a very counterculture kind of perspective. How do you measure success for yourself, or how do you measure failure, or how do you think about those things?
I'm afraid my answer may not be as enlightened as you might think, because I mean, I've considered myself to be a successful person just because of the fact that I've been able to live my life and do things I want to be able to do. For me, the quick answer is that success is about freedom. But at the same time, I also understand that I live in a society that teaches us that success is about something else. Success is about do you have a partner? Do you have a good job? Do you have a 401k? Do you have a house? Do you have a car? Do you have children? Do you have this and do you have that? I don't have a lot of those things that other people consider indicators of success. But I still feel like I have a successful life because I have a life that allows me to do the things I want to do. You know, years ago, I had a friend who told me, who's a very successful person under the traditional standards, who told me that he was more interested in accumulating experiences than in accumulating things. And I'd never heard that before, but it encouraged me to sort of think differently about what I was doing. Like, I had so many wonderful experiences in my life and people I've met and things I've done and places I've gone. I wouldn't trade that for all the money in the world. No, okay, maybe all the money in the world, but I wouldn't trade that for a little less than all the money in the world.
for most of the money.
Okay, hold that thought, Keith. Hold that thought, Jared. I see you getting ready. Okay, hold on. Let's take a quick break right here. We'll be back.
On this week's episode, we're talking about quitting, we're talking about reframing things, and sometimes you just need like a little bit of something just to try it. just to give it a shot, see how it feels, see how it tastes, see what it does for you. You might just need like a bit of a microdose of something. You see what I did there? You see? Did you catch? If you've been listening to this show for any amount of time, you've probably heard about microdosing. And if not, just know that all sorts of people are microdosing daily to feel healthier and perform better. Our show today is sponsored by Microdose Gummies. Microdose Gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good.
Yes, and you know, we talk all the time about how you and I have both use these microdose gummies to help us in our creative pursuits when we, you know, need to turn off one side of the brain and turn on another, when we need to just relax after a very long day, you know? You pop a gummy, and then you start feeling yummy. I was trying to do a rhyme. I don't know if that quite worked, but you know what I mean. That's what I'm trying to say. Microdose is available nationwide. To learn more about microdosing THC, go to microdose.com and use code FANTI to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. Links can be found in the show description. But again, that's microdose.com, code FANTI.
Okay, so now we are back with Keith Boykin talking about his brand new book, Quitting: Why I Left My Job for a Life of Freedom. And amen to that.
I have never quit a job. I have been laid off, similar to Jarrett, and that forced me into freelancing. And it was the best thing that happened to me, you know, career-wise. And which is, you know, allows me to, you know, be right with y'all with like, fuck that job or those people in your life, right, that aren't serving you, or those experiences or whatever. Like, you know, if you need to cut some ties, cut some ties. However, I'm also thinking, you know, just about how, like, how does one actually, you know, make that shift in their head, like, you know, like in a tangible sense? How does one go from, you know, I am going above and beyond the call of duty at my job because I've been told that I need to go above and beyond the call of duty at my job so that I can get a raise, so that I can get a promotion, so that I can, you know, take care of whoever I gotta take care of, right? How does one shift from that point to just doing the quote unquote bare minimum and kind of working and actualizing this like life of freedom, you know, separately? I'm wondering if there was, you know, was there an experience? Was there a thing that you read, something that made you go like, actually, I ain't doing it no more? And like, this was the catalyst. This was the how-to of how I got, how you got to where you are.
There was, and it's funny, I hadn't thought about it in that term, in those terms until you mentioned it, but it actually happened here in Los Angeles years ago. I was working for a nonprofit here in LA in the 90s. And I was bi-coastal between Washington, D.C. and LA. And it was just a very difficult experience for me. I wasn't getting paid on a regular basis. I was starting to wonder whether it was worth my time to do it. I had a very public position. People saw me all the time on TV and everything and in the media, but I wasn't being compensated for it. And so I felt like I was getting all of the bad side, none of the good side of this. Oh, that's not, it's probably not fair, mm-hmm. fair characterization. I felt like I was a fraud in some ways because people thought of me as just being the successful person who's running this organization, who's probably being well compensated for. But I wasn't being well compensated. I wasn't being paid at all. I had the front money to pay the organization and make sure other people on the staff got paid. And it drove me into debt. And I asked myself, well, why am I doing this? Why am I spending all this time and energy working on something, even though I believe in the cause, working on something that is not mine per se? So I think the experience of being frustrated in a job, that was the last job I had, a full-time job I had, that made me think that I don't want to do that again. And I didn't know that was going to be a lifetime decision, by the way. It was just kind of where I was at the moment. Like, I'm ready to try something new. And then I kept trying something mm-hmm. new and something new. And eventually it's like, I'm not going back to that work thing again, you know? So it's a series of steps. It wasn't like a one moment when a light bulb went off. It was like, yeah, you know, fuck this job. It was more of like, I need to move on with my life and try the next thing. So I think the way I would translate that for other people is I would ask people to ask themselves a question. is what you're doing working for you? If it is working for you, you want to continue doing it, then fine. If it's not, and you feel like you're not getting everything you want out of your life and out of your work, then figure out a new way to do it. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying quitting. By the way, when I say quitting, it doesn't mean quit your job. It means quit the mentality that we have to center our lives around work. Which is, I think, also what Beyonce was saying, too.
I was thinking it. I said, yes, that's what Beyonce was trying to tell y'all to do. She ain't telling you to leave your job, okay?
Free yourself.
Period. Fantasia reference. This is what we're here for. I don't know if you meant it as a Fantasia reference, Keith, but I'm going to take it as one. Exactly.
All right. Y'all, my headphones cut out. I missed all the references y'all were talking about. I saw you laughing, but I'm sorry that I missed it.
That's all right.
I want to ask you about this concept from the perspective of moving, because one of the things that I know you thought about for a while was leaving New York and coming to LA. And like, we talked about that extensively, and like, you've been here, and like, I know another friend moved from DC to LA and like was like, you know, my life just feels better. Like, not necessarily about LA. I mean, I always advocate for LA, but like, just the idea of moving and being in a place that you want to be. How did that thought process for you moving here? Because I know you did that with Miami and other places. How do you think about where you want to be?
I think for me, I don't really know that I've had a thought process for how I decide where I want to live. It's just kind of where I'm ready to move on. I don't, you know, people always ask me where I'm from, and that's kind of the tricky question, because I've lived in 12 different cities. I was born in St. Louis, Missouri, and I haven't lived there since I was a child. But I went to 3 different high schools. I went to college in New Hampshire, law school in Boston, worked in San Francisco, LA, Little Rock, Arkansas, you know, St. Louis, Missouri, everywhere, DC, New York, and lived in Miami. And so, like, all these different places, it's kind of like, I think, I know I hate cold weather, so that's one thing. So, I love New York City, I really do, but I just can't deal with the winter there. And I have family in Chicago, and I won't visit them after October because it's too cold there. And then the other thing is, I get tired of places really quickly. You know, I lived in New York for 20 years. On and off, because I had spent 5 years in Miami during that time. But over the course of time, I lived in New York for 20 years. I still have my place in New York, and I still go back from time to time. But, you know, I feel like 20 years is a long time. You kind of, I feel like I like to constantly be moving and changing and trying something new. If I get stuck someplace, I don't really feel like I'm growing as much. I felt like I wasn't doing anything in New York because I'd done everything there was to do in New York. I'd been to the Broadway shows, and I'd been to all the bars and the clubs, and been to the plays and the museums and everything. I met the people who were to meet there, and I'd worked in CNN there and MSNBC there, and I was like, you know what? It's time for me to try something else, you know? I don't want to get stuck. Most people like a sense of stability, but I don't have a man, I don't have a job. I have a pet.
So that's actually the piece for me that I wanted to follow up here, because I think it's interesting, because I can hear people saying to you like, oh, so you don't want to commit to nothing, right? And it's like, oh, you're single, you don't have a job, you have an apartment, like all of these different things. And I'm like, I think for myself, like, I'm kind of okay with that right now, right? Like, I've been thinking about like, I should be buying a house. Should I be getting a car? Like, should I do this? Should I do that? And I'm like, I don't know that I want those things, right? Like, part of me wants to get a house and decorate it and do that myself. And like, I'm that person, right? Like, I have like a lot of vision for that. But I'm also like, I don't even know if I want to be in this country in a year, right? Like, this country is going to shit. And in a couple of weeks, it might really go to shit, right?
Well, hold on
so
now.
I'm like, I mean, it really could, right? The way that this election might be looking. And I'm like, I don't know how long I want to live here. And so I'm having to like kind of question all of those things. Like, what do I want to commit to? How do you respond to that when, if someone is out there thinking like, oh, this is about not wanting to commit to something?
Well, I don't think that's it at all. It's really more about pursuing freedom. You know, I think about this example. I don't know if I wrote about this in the book, but back in 2001, when I was leaving Washington, D.C., the owner of the building that I was living in, and I was renting, I was living in 2 floors of a 4-story row house. With the front yard and the backyard. It's a really nice place. It'd been recently renovated and everything. And the owner of the building offered to sell it to me for $300,000. And this was in a very transitional neighborhood back in the D.C. in the town. And like, you could buy a house in D.C. for $100,000. It's like, $300,000? Why would I spend the $300,000 to buy a house in D.C. in this neighborhood? You know, and, you know, there's still, like, you know, people walking up the street at night doing sex workers and stuff in the community. It wasn't like some sort of high-end neighborhood or whatever. It was just a regular neighborhood. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's just a regular neighborhood. And I said, no, I'm not interested in this. And I moved on and moved to New York City and never looked back. Last time I checked, I don't even want to think about what it's worth now. Last time I checked, that house is worth $2 million, you know. And so, you know, there's a part of me is thinking, wow, I should have bought that house. No. But there's another part of me that's saying that if I had bought that house, and I think I did write about this in the book, and if I had taken the job that would have kept me in D.C. working as a law professor, my life would be completely different. I wouldn't have done half the things I've done in my life. I would never have started the National Black Justice Coalition. I would never have worked for CNN or CNBC or MSNBC. I would never have been on a reality show. I would never have been engaged in things in the way I've been engaged in writing the books that I've been writing or creating the projects I've been creating. Because I would have been stuck in this place in Washington, D.C. just churning out my law review journals and stuff like that and living in this house and taking care of this house and watching my property values appreciate. Nothing wrong with that. I know a lot of people are doing that and living wonderful lives. It's just not the life that I wanted. So it's not about, for me, about being flaky or not committing to something. It's about committing to something else, committing to something called freedom.
I'm into that.
I love that of, like, committing to freedom. There is a polyamorous person who I know who would say the exact same thing about you know, how this shows up in their life. But I'm wondering, how do you think about impact in this conversation? Because I'm a person, I work entirely too much. I know it's a problem, but I work as hard as I work. Because I'm most interested in the impact of what that work can have, you know, for whomever I want or need it to have impact for, right? And for me, you know, at least today, that amount of work, that level of work is worth it. And so I'm wondering, how does impact factor into your kind of concept of work today?
Well, you said two different things here in this question that I wanted to get into. One was about the impact. The other was about the polyamory part, which, you know, I'm also intrigued by.
I was going to say, like, Keith is going to have something to say about the polyamory. We talked about this a lot. Yeah,
exactly. So in terms of the impact part, I think there are a lot of times I feel like I should be working on things. I don't want to do it at that point. And, you know, there is a popular saying in social media, which I think has some truth to it, but it's not necessarily my life experience, which is that discipline is more important than motivation. And people say that because they say, like, you should, particularly in the context of, like, going to the gym. I go to the gym every day, pretty much 5 days a week at least. And they say, you know, discipline is more important than, let's say,
That handshake was like, I could never. That's what that was.
I was hoping that y'all didn't hear that. My apologies.
I think that the important thing is, yes, you can work for things that you work hard on, things that you want to believe in, but to do it in a way that works for you. And if that means you work every day, if that works for you, that's fine. If it means for me not doing that, that's fine too. I just don't like when people tell everybody, this is the one way you should do your life. The whole point of freedom is that there is no one way. What works for you may not work for me. So if that's what you want to do, that's fine. I also have a problem with people on the internet telling everybody, this is how you got to do things to succeed. Because yes, it may work for some people, but it does not necessarily work for everyone else. Now, lastly, polyamory.
Oh, I was going to bring it back.
You know, Jared knows I've talked about this a lot. I'm not in a polyamorous relationship or anything like that. I would not be opposed to it, though. But I just feel like that's another way of people expressing their freedom, of people creating new structures for their lives that don't necessarily fit into the traditional Western Christian heterosexist normative way of doing things. And I don't see a problem with it as long as people are consenting and they're honest and they're adults about this whole thing. And that's where I like to live my life, in that space where I don't want to be bound by old-fashioned rules of monogamy and relationships. I've been in monogamous relationships. I've been in non-monogamous relationships. But at this point in my life, I don't know that I would want to be in another monogamous relationship unless either everything was, like, perfect, and you know what I mean by perfect. I can't even imagine what that would be. Where I would never want to even have sex with somebody else, first of all. And it just had to add some real value to my life to do so.
I just did a tweet that you were talking about when we're about children, and it was a reply to at Jaleesa Lachey, and she says, "Baby, period." Which, first of all, I always love a baby period. But she says, "Baby, life has so much more to offer you than your career. I hope you realize that soon." And that was what prompted me to tweet saying, why do we grow up thinking about and asking kids what they want to do for a living rather than who they want to be? I just realized how weirdly capitalist that is. All I want to grow up to be is free. And as I hear you talking about polyamory, as we're talking about work, as we're talking about like our professional and personal lives, that is something that is more and more important to me. And like, I remember in a previous dating situation, we were having conversation. We were discordant about amory, right? About being monogamous or poly or open or however we wanted to language that. And I said to him, like, we talk about this a whole lot more than I'm fucking anybody else. And like, you see non-monogamy as being about sex, and I see it as being about freedom, right? And so, like, as I hear you talking about freedom, I'm recognizing, like, how much I find myself talking about freedom and how much we talk about it here. And, like, I do want to figure out, like, what that means to us. And I think that it also means something different to every person. How do you define freedom for yourself?
I think you hit the, again, using that old expression. What's another expression for hit the nail on the head? I'll try that one.
It's like, I think you hit the, I'm going to work on it and I'm going to come back.
But no, you're okay. Right. I mean, I love what you said about you define non-monogamy as freedom, you know, and I hadn't used that same phrase before, mm-hmm. but that's exactly how I see it. And that's exactly how I see everything else. The weird part about this for me, and I think you two understand this, is that I think for the vast majority of the people who see me in the world, see me on TV or writing books or in social media, they have this perception of me that I'm this very serious person who follows the rules and does all the things he's supposed to do. And they get weirded out when I do something strange, like post a shirtless picture of myself. Like, that doesn't seem like the person you are. But that's actually more the person who I am than the person they see on social media or the person they see on TV. I am the rebel, freedom-loving person who just likes to live his life doing whatever he wants to do. I just have to play a role to be on TV or to write a book or something like that. But that's not who I am. I wish people could sort of understand that instead of trying to put people in boxes all the time.
It's like, this is a facet of who I am. This is something I can do. It is not all of like my life. And it's interesting that you even use like the shirtless photo piece or something like that, because I think to myself, like, I'm always trying to figure out like where the lines are on like professionalism and sexuality and what you can and cannot do. Mm. Travelle, there was a lot of face there. What was that?
So, you know, Jared, we went to Palm Springs a month ago at this point or whatever.
Uh-oh.
And, you know, I have this video of myself in one of the thongs that I wore. We had a nice little pool moment or whatever.
Listen, we were all very pleased with this pool situation. It was great.
Absolutely. But I have this video of me in one of the mirrors in one of the rooms, you know, and the body is bodying or whatever. But I asked a couple people if I should post it. And they both of them said no, because they thought it was like too sexy. It's just me in a pair of drawers, right? But they thought it was too sexy. They thought it, you know, might conflict with the brand, with the, you know, these expected ideas of, you know, how I in particular am supposed to be showing up in the world. And so it's still sitting in the drafts, but it's in the drafts because I'm like, I'm gonna let this bitch out soon. I don't know when, but she coming out.
But that's the point, right? Like, I'm good for doing, like, an Insta story or a reel walking around the house, right?
You'd be naked.
I don't be, like, super dressed at home all the time. Like, what am I wearing clothes for? you know what I mean? Like, I'm naked or I'm in some shorts or whatever. Like, I don't... So, like, what do I need to be throwing on clothes for? And so, like, it's a conversation that I'm always having with myself as I'm, like, trying to, like, embrace my body, embrace, like, you know, all of myself and all of those different kinds of things. I'm trying to figure out, like, well, what is the line? How do I do this? And I'm thinking about, like, the people that I represent at the organization or the people that I work with or the people that I'm developing projects with. Like, oh, should I should I, I don't know. Like, how do you think about that? And then we got to go.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that as a great place to end too, because I feel like I really love watching you both of you on social media and the ways in which you show up, because it's not just one dimensional. And I think that's important for people to see that. And I think my life has been dedicated to sort of doing something similar. Like, I've tried to be free in who I am, in my persona. And it's often pissed people off because I come across as being what they consider to be a thot or whatever. But I don't care, because I want people, you know, it's like the old Marianne Williamson quote, as we liberate ourselves from our fears, we give other people permission to do that, the same thing too. So I think the more we do that, the more we are allowing ourselves to be who we are in public spaces, we also give other people the permission to do that too. The problem though is that we now live in a branding generation, an era where everybody's talking about branding. You know, even if you have like one follower on social media, everybody's like, well, that may not be consistent with my brand. And, you know, Kanye West notwithstanding, you don't have to live your whole life focused on just what your brand is. You can focus on like other parts of your identity and let people see all of your dimensions of who you are. Just do it in some way that seems respectful to you.
Keith, I'm super excited about your new book. I've been reading it, listening to it. I always enjoy having you on audiobook because I know you and it's almost like talking to you, but like you're not listening back. But it's been fantastic to kind of get to hear your story in this way, because I feel like I'm still like learning new things about you. And I really appreciate this book. Quitting is available right now on Scribd, apparently not Scribd from the way that I fucked that up the first time.
And it's free. You don't have to even buy it. Because it's just like Netflix for books. Just go on tryscribd.com/Boykin. You can download the book and read it for free for 60 days. Doesn't cost you a dime.
Period.
We will make sure to put the link into the show notes. Quitting Why I Left My Job for a Life of Freedom is available right now exclusively on Scribd for free. Go get it. Check it out. Keith Boykin, we thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to get into a little bit of feedback, because let me tell you, we got a voice note that was not pleased about something we said on the show last week. We're going to get into that, and dishonorable mentions are coming up next.
Hi, I'm Jesse Thorne, the founder of Maximum Fun, and I have a special announcement. I'm no longer embarrassed by my brother and me. You know, for years, each new episode of this supposed advice show was a fresh insult, a depraved jumble of erection jokes, ghost humor, and frankly, this is for the best, very little actionable advice. But now, as they enter their twilight years, I'm as surprised as anyone to admit that it's gotten kind of good. Justin, Travis, and Griffin's witticisms are more refined, like a humor column in a fancy magazine. And they hardly ever say bazinga anymore. So, after you've completely finished listening to every single one of all of our other shows, why not join the McElroy Brothers every week for my brother and me. I'm Jesse Thorne. On the next Bullseye, our annual Halloween Spectacular. We'll interview Anna Fabrega from Los Espookies, Monet Exchange from Drag Race, and the great R.L. Stein, creator of Goosebumps.
You know, I don't really get too deep into the real fears. It's a lot safer to do a dummy coming to life.
That's on the next Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Welcome back, beautiful people. We are going to get into our listener feedback segment. We have a voice memo this go around from a one Dr. Diet, our fave. She sent it with the subject line, triggered.
Let me pause you, because saying our fave as singular is going to be a problem for somebody. I don't want to, I'm not calling out people, but I am saying like somebody's going to feel a way about that.
One of our fave? I mean, she could be, you can have multiple favorites.
I'm letting you know about your mentions tomorrow. All I'm saying.
We can have multiple favorites. Dr. Diet is one of my favorite emailers. Why? Because we always talk about her emails being entirely too long. And so, as she says at the beginning of this voice memo, she sent us a voice memo this time. And she's responding to the quote that you read out at the beginning of the fandom standum episode. I forget what we named it. Barbs, Carbs, and Trumpers, I believe Trumpsters. Is what it was called. Trumpsters. Yeah. And so let's take a listen to Dr. Diet.
Good morning, Jared and Trevelle. I thought I'd try a voice message this time and see how that goes over versus my previously long saga emails. So I just wanted to send a quick note about the recent episode. The quote that was read out at the beginning, I know y'all kind of joked that it was a drag, but I couldn't help but notice, especially as a neurodivergent therapist and a therapist who works with many autistic folks and other neurodivergent people, that the quote was really violent. From my perspective, against the groups who are often, who were referenced peripherally in this quote, when we're thinking about Star Wars fans, for example, you know, the language was extreme fandom may serve as a security blanket for the socially inept. Even the use of the word socially inept is really, it's really frustrating. It triggers ableism for me, like it's giving ableism. And you know, we have so many people who struggle with social skills because the world is not built for brains like theirs, or there are certain expectations placed upon how they should be socializing. And things like scripts, even the use of the word script, is something that we know quite a lot about in the autistic community, because scripts are how we help folks navigate how really overwhelming, overstimulating, and oppressive the world can be. And when I think about fandoms like Star Wars or Star Trek or even cosplay, which I do, I think what was missing for me from this conversation was not just the part about community, but the part about identity and how the act of engaging in these communities is also about seeing something about yourself represented in the fandom. And I don't necessarily think that things like Star Trek and Star Wars and cosplay have a one-to-one correspondence with some of the qualities and aspects that you mentioned about being, you know, part of the beehive or a barb. I think music fandom is a completely different animal. And although I do think that there are some parts of it that are definitely adjacent and related, I think if we're talking about things like, you know, socially inept or substitute for social skills, or even the language of excruciatingly boring people to talk to, I'm like, wow, what is this person's problem with people who don't think and interact with the world like them? That was the question that I left with from this quote. Thanks for all you do. Looking forward to hearing more episodes. Bye.
Thank you, Dr. Diet. You know, this, I have to say, well, one, I appreciate you doing the voice memo and even, like, you know, the very specific, like, kind of going through the quote, and particularly the reframing, right? This whole episode thus far has been about, like, reframing how, you know, one sees in particular work and jobs and all of that. Here, Dr. Diet is encouraging us to think differently about how, you know, how in particular this quote that we read out last week, but also, you know, some of the things that we also said, as she said, it's giving ableism. And you know what? I see it. I see it. I see it. And thank you for pointing that out.
Well, one of the things that I thought about immediately when I was hearing her was, like, we did not indicate how old this quote was, because in the moment I was like, I was like, oh, when did he say this, right? But then I was like, mm-hmm. Roger Ebert been good and dead, right? So I just want to acknowledge
good and dead, honey.
Cold, no shade. Roger Ebert died in 2013, right? And so this quote, like I said in the episode, like, it's undated, right? And it's like a screenshot of something that he'd said, but we've heard other people talk about it. But I say that to say, like, the conversation around ableism is different a decade after he has died, right? And I don't know the date that he made that comment, but, like, the conversations around ableism and the ways that we address mental health and mental illness and neurodivergence and all those different things, you know, it's a little bit different than it was back then. And so I will acknowledge that and also say, like, I think she's right, right? Like, as I hear her perspective on it.
But also, you know, yes, the comment is from whenever it is from, but like, you know, it was still fucked up dead.
And her question is right.
Right, still, regardless.
Her question is still right.
Right, right. And yeah. And it would have also been right if lodged at the specific time period, right, in which the quote was said initially as well.
Sure. Thank you so much for your note, Dr. Diet. It's now time for us to get into our dishonorable mentions. I just clap my hands. Do we do that when we say that? All right. It's time for us to get into our dishonorable mentions. These are the stories.
That's what it was given.
That's what that was.
You know, ISO boom.
These are the stories or people that caught our attention this week that deserve a call out, either for their good or for their stupid. Number one, I want to give a shout out to Gabriel Iglesias. He has a new Netflix special called Stadium Fluffy. I'm not super familiar with him from stand-up. I have seen him in different like shows as an actor, as a comedic actor. And his stand-up special, Stadium Fluffy, is fantastic. Like, I saw it and I was like, what is that? And I just wanted to open it and see what it was. And I laughed the entire time. It was interesting to me, like, for a person I don't have like a personal connection to, like with a lot of his work, I was emotional watching it immediately, right? It's filmed at Dodger Stadium, which he's an Angeleno and you know, has a lot of connection here in LA. So to film that at Dodger Stadium and have the response that he had there was really fantastic, and I enjoyed it. So I'd encourage you to go check out Gabriel Iglesias' new special called Stadium Fluffy. I want to give a shout out to the Nissan Foundation. Keith mentioned earlier that I was in Nashville earlier this week, and I should say, like, I was there. I hosted an event for them. They paid me, so this is not an ad. But I do want to shout out the Nissan Foundation's work. I was just really impressed by meeting so many of the grantees. The Nissan Foundation has been around for 30 years. It was founded after the Rodney King uprisings here in Los Angeles to really focus on race and equity and diversity. And so it was an important day, and I was just really excited to be there. So shout out to the Nissan Foundation and also the Alan Lewis Agency who brought me out to do that. Joycelyn Coley over there has always been really awesome. I want to give a shout out to the members of our board at the National Association of Black Journalists of Los Angeles, including you, Travelle, because we've been doing a lot of work lately getting ready for different projects and initiatives and things that we're coming up with to offer to our members and to our community. And I'm just really impressed by the creativity, the innovation, the ideation, the camaraderie amongst all of our team. Lastly, I just want to say like a quick little moment about Kanye. It just continues to blow my mind that people have like fully rational conversations about Kanye West and never discuss mental illness. Now, mind you, that does not excuse the shit that he has said, right? It does not make what he's done okay. And I'm sure that by the time this episode comes out, from the time that we're recording it, there will be some more bullshit. But like, it is just frustrating to me that like, it's just never a part of the conversation around Kanye West, or it's not enough in the places that I see, I should say.
Well, I would encourage those who feel similarly to you. There are spaces having that, you know, complex, nuanced, well-rounded conversations about that man.
I want to acknowledge to that point, I'm also not seeking those places out because I don't give a fuck.
Well,
right? So
here we are. I just have one honorable mention this week, and it came from the gods. You want to know why it came from the gods? Because I got this email shortly, immediate, like minutes before we started recording this morning that reads, Rihanna leads the Black Panther Wakanda Forever soundtrack with new original song called Lift Me Up. And here is where I say, give Rihanna her Oscar. We need it. It is time. I would love to see her perform this original ditty, okay, on the Oscars stage. Because why the fuck not? And how, and she's performing at the Super Bowl, which I believe is in the spring.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
Isn't that normally in the spring?
That, yeah, that'll be February-ish.
Okay. Yeah. Give us Rihanna at the Super Bowl and Rihanna at the Oscars. Why the fuck not? I love this for me. Give her her Oscar. Because y'all keep playing in Beyonce face. I know the songs weren't good, okay? I know it wasn't the best song. I knew she wasn't going to get... But still, I'm just saying. Just give her her Oscar and then she'll sit down somewhere. You know? Y'all the problem, not her.
y'all the problem, not her. I will say that Rihanna is performing at the Super Bowl on February 12th. The Oscars, well, she'll also be performing because you know that the song is probably going to be up there, will be March 12th, a month later, the 95th Academy Award. So shout out to that. I haven't heard the song. Have you heard it?
I have not heard it. It does not come out, but it is now available for pre-order or whatever. Obviously, the Black Panther film sequel comes out November 11th, so in a couple weeks. But I haven't heard it. But, you know, it's Rihanna. It's the first track that we will have of hers, if I'm not mistaken, right? However long since Anti, one of the namesakes of this show.
I don't think that's how that works. Anyway, what if the song's really bad? Like, what if we hate it?
Guess what? Songs that I hate every single day are at the top of the charts. They get the awards. They get the honors and the adulation and the accolades. Why not? Okay? Anyway, it's time for... Black History is happening every day. This week's honor and focus is going to a one Tina Fabrique. Or maybe it's Fabrique. Maybe it's just Fabric.
I think it's Fabrique.
You may not know the name, but I promise you know the voice. Take a listen.
It's butterfly in the sky. I can go twice as high. Take a look. It's in a book. A reading rainbow. I can do anything. Ways to grow and things to know. A reading rainbow, a reading rainbow, a reading rainbow.
Amen.
Glory to God.
Period.
Have y'all seen that gif of Oprah singing in the audience, but you know she's fucking up the words? that was one of the most consistent things on the Oprah show. Like, people would be performing live and she would not know them lyrics, but she'd be like singing along with the wrong words. Very much me and Travelle over here messing up on what part of the song we were on. That's what that was giving.
It's always that middle part. It's that middle part.
It's like, I can't go anywhere, but girl, do all it,
do anything, something like that. Anyway, Tina Fabrique, she is the voice who sang the iconic Reading Rainbow theme song. Jarrett, this video dropped into your spirit and your world this week.
I have had this in queue for a little bit because we shared the Gladys Knight Sesame Street song, and I saw this like the next day and I was like, oh, this feels like that, sort of. Mm-hmm. So I was really excited to be able to use this here for Black History is Happening Every Day. All right. We want to let y'all know you can find Travelle and I on another podcast that just came out. There's a new show called Black People Love Paramore. It's hosted by Sequoia Holmes, and she's a friend of mine. And this was a really fun episode. We were talking about a lot of the things that are not necessarily associated with Black folks loving them. And so we spent the whole episode with Sequoia, and you guys can go check that out. Again, the show is called Black People Love Paramore, hosted by Sequoia Holmes. Go check it out. It's a lot of fun and you are going to enjoy it. We've already told you that if this conversation piqued your interest and you want just a little bit more of this here.
Good.
We have two other episodes with Keith Boykin where Keith is my co-host on one of them, and also I'm talking about his new book. So you can go check out those episodes. Also, the Kanye West episode still exists as well. So you can go check those things out. We thank you so much for listening to the show. We thank you for being so loyal to the show. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts or any of the platforms that allow you to rate or subscribe, we ask that you do. And share that show with a friend as well, with someone that you love, someone that you care about, or that you enjoy having conversations with around topics. What?
Or somebody you hate. I don't care whether you like them or not.
Send them the Kanye episode if you hate them. Right? Like, and start up that angry conversation. If you have a comment or a suggestion about this week's show, we're at Fanti Podcast on both Instagram and Twitter. Use the hashtag FantiFam, or you can send us an email to fanti@maximumfun.org.
And always, if you want to give us some of your coins, you want to help become a financially contributing member of the Fanti fam, you can do that at MaximumFun.org/join. Our music is brought to you by Corece, that's Core.ece, wherever you get slay-worthy music. Our graphics are done by Ashley Wood and the folks over at Moonhouse Creative, and our editor is Nihar Patel.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher! This is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.
Y'all will, if I have some clavicle out, honey, the girls sometimes will be like, oh, you're doing a lot.
I was thinking about clavicle or cleavage, because I've seen both.
First of all, I'm not doing this with you.
Okay.